but changing it. You're listening to WBPU LP St. Petersburg. This is WUBP LP St. Petersburg.
You are listening to Diasporic Music on Black Power 96.3, Norman Otis Richmond and Melinda Francis. And we came out of the box today with the music of Belinda Brady. She did a takeoff on Robert Nesta Marley and the Wailers' Missing You. And she is based here in Toronto, Canada. We're getting ready to play a half an hour of Canadian lovers rock. And I would like to thank two people, Chairman O'Malley Ishitella, who gave me the space on Black Power 96.3. And I also would like to thank Archie Shipp, who gave me the concept of Diasporic Music, music made in the West, but not of the West. And Chairman O'Malley Ishitella is the chair of the African People's Socialist Party. And we have an exciting show for you today, and we're going to be speaking with England, and we're going to be speaking with Jackson, Mississippi. We're going to be talking to Emma Lewis from the UK and Kali Okuno, who is based in Jackson, Mississippi. And we also have a tribute to Hugh Masekela. He had a great song called Steamilla. It was about a coal train, and it was not about John Williams coal train. It was about a coal train in that took workers from all over Southern Africa. One of my favorite songs by Hugh Masekela, Steamilla. And I saw Calypso Rose on Saturday night, and
how was that?
Oh, that was excellent. She was out, as Charlie Wilson would say, was outstanding. And it was she basically talked about her roots. She came out of the box with a song called African, and she said she could trace her roots. Her great grandmother, who she knew, she said her great grandmother lived till she was 5, and her great grandmother was from Guinea. Guinea, the great country of Ahmed Sekou Touré and Samori Touré, and her great grandfather was from South Africa, and she talked about women's the emancipation of women. She talked about domestic workers, and she talked about like a political rally she had, and she got a little X-rated, and she's a very humorous and very political woman. It was a excellent show. She was backed up by a local group called Kobo, and they are on tour. They tour with her sometimes, and she has a lot of ties with the Francophone community in France and in the diaspora. And I think her manager, her road manager, or her manager is from Belize. So she's all over the place in terms of the world. But the show was
touring, up. Yeah.
Yes. And how have you been doing?
I've been doing good. I'm in transition, so I'm going back to school. So that's going to be a big change. But so I was kind of just preparing for that. And it was really nice out today. Like, the weather is beautiful. It's probably going to freeze in the next week, and that's going to be a little bit shocking. But other than that, everything's good today.
Oh, yeah, I was out. It was nice. It's nice. But we're getting ready to get started. We're getting ready to play some Ajabin. We're going to hear some Divine Brown, and we're going to hear Jay Douglas, all Toronto-based artists who do music. And Divine Brown is known as an R&B artist, but she's going to do a reggae song. And Jay Douglas came to Toronto from Jamaica, and he started out doing a lot of R&B, but he's doing more and more and more reggae. And Jabin was a used to have an R&B band. I met Jabin when he was a teenager. Now he's doing, I think Jabin is doing only reggae, but this is Jabin, Divine Brown, and Jay Douglas.
Close enough to die.
Nanga Def is Wolof, and they speak Wolof in Senegal, the Gambia, Mauritania, and around the world. And that's the greetings in Wolof, great language out of Africa. And we just heard from Jay Douglas from Montego Bay, who came to Toronto, I guess, when he was going to high school. Divine Brown, I think Divine Brown was born and raised here in Toronto. And Jabin is out of Trenchtown, but he lives in Ontario now. And a special part of me, I think he did, that was an Ambrosia song, a great pop song. And we're getting ready to listen to, we're going to be speaking with Emma Lewis and Kali Akuna. But right now we're getting ready to play some more local music from Nana McLean. This is Nana's Melody. Medley, pardon me, and we're going to hear from Leroy Sibbles, who's going to be doing some R&B-based song out of Stax, and but let's listen to Nana McLean right now.
You know, I decided to bring back the old high school days. So catch this.
You are listening to Diasporic Music on Black Power 96.3. Melinda Francis, Norman Richmond, and on the line from the UK is Emma Lewis. And Emma Lewis has been a guest on Diasporic Music several times, and we wanted to basically get an update as to what is taking place in the UK. It's a very, very dreadful situation, we understand, in terms of working people in the UK. Emma Lewis, how are you doing today?
I'm fine, Norman. And you?
Me and Melinda, we're here, and the sun is shining. There's plenty of light. It's very nice outside, and we've had some very terrible weather this season, and we have a break today.
Good for you. It's dark and horrid here. Hi, Melinda.
Hi. Nice having you back on the show.
Thank you.
I guess the first question we wanted to ask you is, could you give us a review of what took place in the UK in 2017?
Well,
highlights.
I think the most significant, perhaps, thing is this whole business about Brexit with Theresa May. And you remember her hubris and arrogance when she called that election. And, of course, she lost her majority. But this woman is so incompetent. You know, she's never come up with any idea that was even faintly sane. Like, she came up with the dementia tax. Well, that didn't go down too well. The dementia tax was because there's a change, if there's a change in social care. So suppose you're older and you require care in your own home, you would have to pay for it through the value of your house once you have died. So the entire value of a person's home would be claimable by the state. That's what she was proposing. I mean, we live in I think you've got the same thing. We've got a socialized medicine. So,
yes.
You know, it's just outrageous. Anyway, she had to do a U-turn on that because people just weren't having it. Then she wanted to bring back grammar schools. I don't know if you know what grammar schools are, but grammar schools are a selective education where you take a test at 11 and then you go to a separate school from the people who didn't pass the test.
Right.
All the studies have shown that selective education harms the life chances of the poorest students, and it's socially divisive. It's also divisive within families, because I passed the 11 plus and my sister didn't, and it caused a lot of problems in my family. And for every success, there are many, many more examples of lost potential. Now, anybody who's sane would know that you don't go back to a system like that. But no, Theresa May wanted to go to bring that back. Then she wanted to bring back fox hunting. You know, this is a cruel sport. Nobody in their right mind would promote, but this is, the woman's mental. And she also sent around lorries with messages on the side saying, immigrants, go home. You know, telling people who are undocumented. She also said that the children of immigrants. Now, my parents were immigrants, right? And she says the children of immigrants should not be allowed to go to school. She's totally inhuman.
Right.
She is a robot. And you know, the society is in a state of political and moral disintegration anyway. And they brought in the brutality of 0 hours contracts. I don't know if you have them there. 0 hours contracts is and workfare, which is forced labor.
Right. Yeah. No. We have.
Yeah. Which officially it knocks down the unemployment rates, the unemployment figures, which that's the whole idea. But it does nothing for the pockets of workers.
So, you know, everything she proposes is disastrous. I mean,
yeah.
workers in every country face similar conditions, you know, the decline in our living standards and the threat of war because of that madman, those people south of you have in the White House. Well,
yeah.
wherever we live, you know, workers, we've got essentially the same class interests, and workers in every country have to face this. But they've cut the education budget so badly that now we've actually got a situation where there are millions of people who don't understand how the system works and who are easily manipulated to vote against their own best interests. You know, because like Brexit, that was primarily hate disguised as patriotism.
Yeah.
You know? And there's just millions of people in this country who lack any sort of knowledge about history or the basic facts of how the world works. And so they were able to manipulate people. And they're so afraid of people who don't look like them or who are different in some way. So they voted to leave.
Emma, could I ask you this question? How do the immigrants get along with one another? Is there a united front, or has the system been able to divide people and get them fighting one another? I wanted you to answer that and continue, because that's just on my mind.
Well, as you know, the biggest fear of our rulers is that one day workers will get together and recognize that class is the real struggle. So they've worked hard at keeping us apart and, you know, making divisions and creating divisions where there aren't any. So, no, we haven't got a united situation. That was the reason why many people, especially on the left, were for remaining, because we saw this as a way of leaving would mean dividing the working class even further. When we were in the union, at least, you know, workers could support one another through strike action and so forth. Because, as you know, production is now globalized. So we've got more power in that sense, but unfortunately.
And you are listening to Diasporic Music on Black Power 96.3. And Melinda, you had a question?
Yeah, Emma, you were speaking just before we got on to the show, sort of experience of a friend of yours who, you know, like a lot of nurses I'm a daughter of a nurse, so I know there's like a lot of people that move around through nursing, who's working in London, but basically because of the climate is now moving back to Europe. So did you want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, as I said, we have a terrible crisis in the NHS. The NHS, they haven't been funding, giving them the funds that they need. And you can't really run a health service on the cheap. But what's been happening is that gradually they've been trying to privatize the NHS because, as I said, we've got socialized.
Excuse me, Emma, what is the NHS?
The National Health Service, sorry. Yeah.
Okay.
I'm sorry,
National Health Service, yeah. So they've been trying to privatize the National Health Service, and they've been starving it of funds, and gradually people are just, the nurses and doctors are getting fed up and leaving, and we've had such a terrible crisis this winter because, as I said, people are in the back of the ambulance waiting half an hour. There are people in the corridors. You know, doctors are saying they can't, if someone has a heart attack, it's hard for them to get through all the people blocking the corridor to take them to the resuscitation unit. That's how bad things are. The NHS is just in real crisis, and Theresa May is not willing to put any money in the NHS. She's living in another world.
she's actually, she sounds like,
Yeah, it's very similar.
Sounds like Trump.
I think she likes Trump and Trump likes her.
They've
got a mutual admiration society going between those two dumb creatures. They don't know what they're doing. This situation is so bad because, for example, now in Lambeth, I live in Lambeth. This is a borough in London. And 26% of Lambeth is black. That is African Caribbean, Somali, Nigeria, whatever. And they say that 16.2% of the people, of the black people, have a mental disorder, right? So that's like depression, OCD. And right. Half of them, it's severe enough to warrant treatment. Now, all the studies have shown that the risk of mental disorder increases with socioeconomic deprivation. That is low-paid work, unemployment, homelessness. So that men in the lowest income bracket are three times more likely to have a mental disorder than those in the highest income households. Now, you don't need a degree to work that out. Everybody can see that that is how it works.
Right.
Now, in Lambeth, there are higher rates of homeless households and unemployment, poorer than average rates of education, and relatively high rates of looked after children. I don't know what you call looked after children in your place.
Foster care.
Looked after children are children that are in social care, that the government has taken them away from their families because their families are ill or can't cope or something, or homeless. Yes, you have that?
Yes. Children of the state or foster care.
Not just foster, because the foster is when they're in a home of a family. These are institutionalized.
But yeah, they're wards of the state. Basically, like the guardian is the state.
That's right. They're institutionalized.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So all of those things contribute to a higher risk of mental disorder. Now, in terms of the severe mental illness, the NHS, that's the National Health Service, stats on mental health. They found a 15-fold difference between prevalence of SMI, that is severe mental illness, in black men, 3.1% compared to white men, 0.2%, mainly psychotic disorders, schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. Now, SMI is also socioeconomically determined. All the studies show that, especially in men, with the risk increasing as income goes down. Which would make sense. The poorer you are, the more likely you are to go nuts, isn't it? So
yeah.
That
makes a lot of sense.
Yeah,
it does to us. Yeah. So that for the lowest quintile of household income, the risk for men, black men, is nearly 10 times that of people in the wealthiest fifth. Now, these studies, they're not taking into account something that you and I know that should be taken into account seriously, and that is racism, right? Because black people make up over 50%, 50 of the acute psychiatric wards. Black people are more likely to be admitted to the secure services. That means they've been sectioned. Now, you know how destructive racism is to us. And to humans anywhere. I was working in this place before I'd been thrown out of teaching because of political activity. And I was trying to retrain to be a librarian. So I got this job in a council, that is the local government office, as an allocation officer. That means that you allocate housing to people who are in need, yeah?
Yeah.
And there was a young black man there. Blaze, and he was working as a housing officer, so he would go around to these horrible, unfit for human habitation premises and assess these people to be rehoused by the council, by the local government.
Right.
And he decided, well, he would do some studies and retrain. I was retraining to be a librarian. He wanted to retrain to be a surveyor. I don't know what you call them there. Surveyor, somebody who, I don't know, how do you say that? They kind of overlook the property when the council is going to pull down a building. Okay. And when the new building comes up, they give them when the order to commence the demolition and so on. So anyway, right. This guy passed the exams and decided to apply for a job in another borough, the adjoining borough to Lambeth, which is called Lewisham. So he went for the interview. They weren't at the. It was after the rebellion, I think. There was a rebellion, and they started giving a couple of black people jobs, you know, in these areas. So he went for the job. He got the job. And from day one, those workers, white workers, because he was the only black, those white workers did not want to have a black manager, and they were not going to have him. They did so many terrible things to him, I can't even tell you on the phone. And one morning, he went in. I mean, they would do things like take the chair, the leg off the chair, so when he sit down, the chair would collapse and he would fall. One morning, he went in, this Blaze, the brother. So one morning he went in and someone had defecated on his desk. Wow. And when he stood there, he just stopped at the coffee shop and bought a cup of coffee, you know, in those plastic, those kind of coffee things. And he had it in his hand, and two of them came in and started laughing. They had actually defecated on the manager's desk, and they came in laughing. And he just threw the hot coffee in the face of one of these monsters. Anyway, they called the police, and he was sectioned. And they put him in a secure unit. And I won't bother to tell you all the horrible details of all that that guy went through. It destroyed his marriage, you know. But black people are treated differently, you know, because my cousin at 18, he went to university and tried to experiment with herb. Now, not everybody can smoke herb. So he went psychotic. Right. He was sectioned. They put him in the madhouse. He was there. We went to visit him. When we went in there, we were so shocked at this place because, you know, over 50% of the place is black, and we are only like, you know, 12% in London. So I can't even tell you all of that. It's so horrible. Anyway, he never came out alive, right, because of all the drugs they pumped him with. Same what happened to Blaze. Now, I have a white friend who had a son, just like my cousin, 18 years, went and tried herb, went psychotic, got sectioned, went into the madhouse. But he, after a couple of months, he was okay, and he came out. They didn't pump him with the same drugs.
Right.
And he's alive now. And my cousin is dead. You see, so we, as you well know, we experience this whole health service in a totally different way. For example, the ambulances. So many black people, their children have a sickle cell crisis, or they're having an asthma attack. When they call the ambulance comes. These racists who are, you know, white supremacist activists but actually have on a uniform come in and say, no, the child isn't sick enough to go to the hospital. It'll be all right. And, of course, the child dies. One poor woman, she took the child in a taxi, and the child died by the time they got to the hospital. I had a bad asthma attack. My mother is a very, very placid woman, not confrontational at all. And she called the ambulance, and the ambulance came, and they said I wasn't sick enough, and they weren't taking me to the hospital. And my mother went berserk. She said, you're not a doctor. You're taking my child to the hospital now.
Yeah,
and I went.
Yeah,
they
yeah.
took me to the hospital. I was in intensive care for a week. And these people said I wasn't sick. I wasn't sick enough to go to the hospital. So we experience everything differently. Because we are black, they think that we're not human beings. Even black children are suffering so much. You would not believe the way they treat these children in the hospital. And this is they're saying that their study found that there's an increased incidence of psychotic illnesses in black people. But the funny thing is that this same study showed that this increase in the incidence of psychotic illnesses disappeared once they were part of an area where more than 25% of the population was black. So can you see there's something here that should be explored? Why is it that when we live in areas where there's a few more black people, that 25% of the population is black, there is a dramatic drop in the incidence of psychotic illnesses? That means something is out there, doesn't it? But they don't want to explore that. You know, they don't want to explore it. Okay, so it might be social support, it might be social capital mitigating the effects of racism. But right. This is something that needs to be explored, but nobody wants to deal with it. Nobody is keeping track of the number of young black kids and that who have asthma attacks, sickle cell crisis, that the ambulance leaves and dies. Nobody's keeping track of it.
Yeah. Colonialism, I think there was a study, it might have even been done by people in the African People's Socialist Party, that colonialism basically makes, I won't say crazy, but it's caused mental illnesses, colonialism causes people to have mental issues.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely. You can't be the focus of, I don't know if you saw that thing, there was a thing with the African Americans, some brother had a job in some computer place, and his friend said, he told him that nothing he did would please the boss, everything he did was wrong, he couldn't do anything to please his boss. And when I read it, I thought, my God, I've been there, I know exactly what this guy is going through. Unfortunately, right. The poor guy, he had three young children, preschool kids. He was married with three young, and he killed himself. And I thought, oh my God, what a waste, you know. But I can imagine that this man felt that there was no way out, because he probably, this job was probably the only job he could get. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
The whole thing is terrible, but God, nobody's taking any notice.
So you guys are, you have coalitions dealing with the issue of the abject poverty, you said before we came on the air.
Yeah, with the children, because in social housing, I don't know, you probably have social housing there.
Yes.
The people, if you live in social housing, it's not necessarily because people don't have jobs. Some of them have jobs. Like in my community where I live now, some people have jobs, but the jobs are pay poverty wages, so they can't pay their rent. So they still have to get benefits. State has to help them. Instead of the state telling these criminal employers, pay these people a living wage, they allow them to get away with paying these people poverty wages, and then the state, that is the taxpayer, me and you, who work, have to pay for the state to pay these people's rent. You know?
Right.
And we're not rich. The employers have got enough money. They're making enough profit. They can pay these people a decent wage, but they won't do it. And the government doesn't do anything about that. The government just says, okay, you'll have to get benefits. Imagine you're going to work every day and you still have to get benefits. And they treat you like dirt when you go to the benefit office. They humiliate you. I mean, when I lost my job and I was on the dole, oh, Lord, whenever you go down there, they just make you feel like dirt. And, if I wasn't unemployed, these people wouldn't have a job. And they can't see that. That is why when the rebellion started in North London, the first place they burnt down was the job center.
The job center, yes, yes.
That makes sense.
Oh, gosh.
You know, people really know who's oppressing them, don't they?
Yeah, they do. you know, when we went to China, we told them about the vast numbers of our people who were going mad, and how, you know, we were so concerned, what can we do? And you know what the Chinese said to us? They said, people only go mad when they don't know what is oppressing them. You have to work harder. Once they can see that it's the system that is oppressing them, they won't go mad. They will resist. And, you know, but we don't have access to the population, unfortunately. We don't have, you know, so people are just...
But, you know, I don't want to cut you, but I was listening to an interview with Fela's son, Seung Kuti, and they asked him about Trump. And he said, you know, people are talking about Trump. It's not Trump, it's the system. You know, we're so obsessed with these personalities. We have to, I guess, as a people, we have to realize that it's imperialism and capitalism that's really the problem, not the personalities.
Indeed, indeed. If it wasn't Trump, it would be somebody else. And after all, Barry didn't do anything anyway to change things for the majority. So
you can't call the president Obama Barry. No, but I'm saying you never call Obama President Obama Obama. You always call, ever since I've known you, you've always referred to him as Barry.
Yeah.
Barry. Yeah, oh. Barry, that's Obama's his name in Hawaii, right?
That's right. He said that school, white people Barack.
Oh.
Yeah. So he told them it was all right for them to call him Barry. So if white people can call him Barry, then I can call him Barry. After all, let's look at it this way. As African people, we can say Nathaniel and Bartholomew, but they can't say Barack. Explain that to me.
Yeah, I know you've been calling him Barry ever since I knew you. He was always Barry to you.
Oh gosh.
Barack Hussein Obama.
Mm-hmm.
Brother man from the motherland, but let me shut up. Is there anything else you'd like to add, Ms. Emma?
Yeah. Well, just that this health thing, it's hard. If you're the object of hate, you know, constantly, it's bound to affect your mental health. And the abuse that people have to suffer on the street, at the bus stop, at work, because some of these managers are real monsters, and they just take out their frustrations on the black workers, you know. So it's no wonder that people are having mental health problems. And for them not to acknowledge and to realize what is at the root of this thing, it's worrying. It's like our children. I don't know if you've seen anything on the news on that, but our kids are killing each other at an alarming rate. And all this self-hate is what is drilled into them at school. I mean, everything in this society says, hate black, hate black. Even black people hate black people. So we are in a terrible crisis. Our kids hate themselves. And they're killing each other. Every day there's a new stabbing. And these are kids who are just, 14, 15, you know. And the schools, of course, the schools are absolute shambles because they decided to, of course, the state doesn't want, they've taken away the education funding because they don't want to have a first-class public education system that teaches people critical thinking skills. Because that's against their interests. They wouldn't be able to manipulate people to vote against their own best interests. So that is why we have such shabby schools. And they don't care. May, as I said, that woman is a deluded, crazy woman. So we're in a situation now where, I don't know, I was in the bank, I got mugged, and I had to go into the bank to tell them that, you know, all my cards had gone and everything. And there was a young black man in the bank, and he said to me, look at all we've been through for these kids and for them to now be killing each other like the way they are. And I could see the pain in this man. He this young man. He has two young boys, kids. You know, and I could see the pain in the man, and I didn't know, you know, what do I say? These kids have gone wild killing each other, and it's all because the whole society is programming them to destroy themselves.
Emma, we have, sorry about that, but we have to bring you back because we've run out of time.
Okay, that's okay. Thanks for having me. Bye.
Take care. And we have been speaking with Emma Lewis, and now we're getting ready to pay tribute to Shu Masekela.
We have the interests of the people at heart. Power to the people. You're listening to WBPU, LP, WBP, LP,
St. Petersburg.
Uhuru, you are listening to Gaius Fork Music on Black Power 96.3. This is Norman Otis Fitzman and Melinda Francis, and we are paying tribute to Hugh Masekela, who was born on April 4th, 1939, and he joined the ancestors on January 23rd, 2018. This is our tribute to Hugh Masekela. Are listening to Dallas Music on Black 96.3. We are paying tribute to the late, great Hugh Masekela. And we just heard Grazing in the Grass. And I think Grazing in the Grass was his first big hit record in the United States. Hugh Masekela was from South Africa. As you know, he was in exile in the United States. And in 1968, he recorded Grazing in the Grass. But in 1966, 1967, he was living in Los Angeles, and he used to hang around Los Angeles City College. and we had some interactions with him. And at that time, LACC, Los Angeles City College, had people like Al Prentice, Bunchy Carter, who went on to become the Deputy of Defense of the Black Panther Party, Southern California chapter. We also had Earl Randall, who went, came from Memphis, Tennessee, and went back to Memphis, Tennessee, and recorded with High Records. He recorded with Al Green and Peoples. We also had people like Masaya Kariga Kenyatta, who was originally from St. Louis, but he went to Detroit and became a big-time disc jockey, Masaya Kariga Kenyatta. And we also had a young man, two young men, one man by the name of Sigidi Abdullah and Dar Malik El Bey, and they went on to work with the SOS band, produce that song, Baby Take Your Time, Do It Right. And they also were hanging around Hugh at that particular time. And right now we wanted to play, maybe this is my favorite song by Brother Hugh Masekela. It's called Coltrane, Steve Miller.
That comes from Namibia and Malawi. There's a train that comes from Zambia and Zimbabwe. There's a train that comes from Angola and Mozambique, from Lesotho, from Botswana, from Swaziland, from all the hinterlands of southern and central Africa. This train carries young and old African men who are conscripted to come and work on contract in the gold and mineral mines of Johannesburg and its surrounding metropoli. 16 hours or more a day for almost no pay. Deep, deep, deep down in the belly of the earth, when they are digging and drilling for that shiny, mighty, evasive stone, or when they dish that mishmash mush food into their iron plates with the iron shovel, or when they sit in their stinky, funky, filthy, flea-ridden barracks and hostels, they think about the loved ones they may never see again, because they might already have been forcibly removed from where they last left them, or wantonly murdered in the dead of night by roving and marauding gangs of no particular origin. We are told to think about their lands and their herds that were taken away from them with the gun and the bomb and the tear gas and the Gatling and the cannon. And when they hear that choo-choo train, a chucking and a pumping and a smoking and a pushing and a pumping, crying and a steaming and a chicken and a they always cuss and they curse the coal train. The coal train that brought them to Johannesburg. Thank you.
Rescue.
Lafia, you are listening to Dire Sport Music on, you're listening to Dire Sport Music on Black Power 96.3, and we just heard Soweto Blues with Mary Nikeba and Hugh Masekela, and one time they were married and they were close before they came to the United States, and they remained close up until the time Mary Nikeba joined the Ancestors. And Hugh Masekela was not a member of the African National Congress, nor was he a member of the Pan-Africanist Congress of Azania, but his sister, Barbara Masekela, was a big official in the African National Congress. And we're getting ready to play a song that Hugh wrote calling for the release of Nelson Mandela. Bring him back home. This is Hugh Masekela. On this particular track, Hugh Masekela is joined by Marcus Miller. Marcus Miller was born in Brooklyn, New York, and his roots are from Trinidad. He is related to Wynton Kelly. The great Wynton Kelly was his cousin. Wynton Kelly was a young man who played piano. He played on Naima with John Coltrane. He also played with Miles Davis, and Marcus Miller is a giant in the music. He plays with Miles Davis as well, and he is on this particular track with Hugh Masekela.
Please welcome the brilliant Hugh Masekela with Hugh is accompanied by John Beasley, Marcus Miller, Mino Sinelu, Guillaume Perret, Avishai Cohen, Lee Ritenour, Michael Mayo, and Kelly Lee Evans performing Mandela, Bring Him Back Home.
A little more than 50 years ago, a group of young South African men were arrested and thrown into prison and sentenced to death for leading their people in the fight against apartheid. A little over 20 years ago, these same men were released from prison. And when they came out, they were very old, but their spirit wasn't broken. And they said to us, "Don't burn your country down like other people do when they get their freedom. But instead, let us build this country together with those who oppressed us before. And let us forgive them, but we should never forget. And never again in the future of this land will one group of people ever get to dominate another again." And contrary to what a lot of naysayers and unbelievers thought, 2 days ago, 3 days ago, on the 27th of April, 2015, the people of South Africa celebrated their 21st anniversary as a free nation. And all those wonderful old geezers, many of them are leaving us now, and the ones that are still with us are very frail and old. But we will always cherish the legacy and the heritage they left for us. So I want to see all of you stand up here and shake a little booty. Let's shake a little booty here for all those old geezers and old man Nelson Mandela. Let me see you move to the left, to the right.
Bring back Nelson Mandela.
You are listening to Dallas Spork Music on Black Power 96.3, Norman Richmond and Melinda Francis. And this is Diasporic Music. Joining us on the line from Jackson, Mississippi, the home of one of the greatest leaders that Africans in America produce, Medgar Evers, who was assassinated in 1963. And we have on the line Polly Akuno from Jackson, Mississippi, Corporation in Jackson. How are you doing today, Kali?
Doing good. Pleasure to be here.
Now, what is, I guess for people that don't know, could you just give us a brief history of Medgar Evers? And he was assassinated in 1963, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, most folks, I would say, you know Medgar for his work within the context of the NAACP of setting up the infrastructure for the organizing drive that took place largely under the auspices of SNCC and COFO here in Mississippi, you know, with the Monitor to Freedom Summer and the work that folks like Fannie Lou Hamer and folks did in 64 going to the Democratic Party National Convention and challenging that. You know, but the patient organizing work, the things that, you know, you don't see around building a network, you know, building, you know, relationships over the course of a couple of decades, you know, Medgar was one of those organizers, and he enabled, you know, the work that Ella Baker folks set up that enabled people to come into Mississippi and have safe places to, you know, rest their heads. You know, have places for people to go to up in the Delta and know that they was going to be fed, you know, that the night riders wasn't just going to automatically, you know, come through and snatch people up without a fight, you know. So that type of, you know, digging deep amongst your people, working in the churches, working in the pool halls, working in the stores, working in the factories. Megan did that work, that patient work. And that was one of the key reasons why he wound up being assassinated. It wasn't just for him speaking out, but it was the actual force that he constructed, you know, that had to be contended with. It had to be dealt with, you know, as far as the forces of white supremacy were concerned, that they were trying to eliminate when they struck him down. You know, so the work that SNCC and COFO, you know, wound up doing, that big public mass work that started happening from 61 on, they were deliberately trying to take that out because it was changing relationships and changing the power dynamics. You know, but his memory, his legacy definitely still lives on here in almost every way that you can kind of imagine. You know, again, folks got to remember when Medgar was here organizing in Jackson, you know, Jackson was a majority white city. So most people might read in history and look at Jackson now, which is a majority, you know, a black city, majority African city, you know, 80 to 85%, and think that those were the dynamics then. It was more or less about 20 to 25%, you know, in Megas time. So, you know, imagine doing that type of work under profoundly different conditions. And I think you get a sense of the measure of the man you know, what type of courage and conviction and commitment that he had. When you talk about, you know, measure what we want people to aspire to be, he's definitely somebody I think we need to take a closer look at and examination of, you know, particularly for this generation that's trying to be involved in the struggle, you know, and change the world.
Let me say that, first of all, I have a question. What is COFO? I don't know what that is. So I know other people.
COFO was the alliance of civil rights organizations that emerged here in Mississippi in 61. You know, 61 to 62. So it was the particular alliance between SNCC, SCLC, the NAACP. You know, the NAACP that was his primary organization. But core, you know, so there was some unique kind of challenges that folks, you know, face, because we have to remember in real time, you know, people have kind of a rosy picture, false picture, about, you know, how the movement was taking place at that time, and people have to remember that there was a competition amongst those organizations, you know, for resources. There were also the contention between different ideologies and politics between those organizations, but also within those organizations. And, you know, in that period after SNCC's development, when Ella and, you know, folks came together here, initially under the impetus of the SCLC, at least we forget. But, you know, Ella made a real push.
SCLC was the students' organization. SCLC, the student, what is it, the Southern Christian Leadership Council was King's organization, correct?
King's organization, yeah. You know, right. So after the sit-in movement, Ella Baker, who was a long time organizer in many different, you know, formations, many different causes, you know, going back to the 1930s. So by that time, you know, you're talking about 30 years of veteran organizing, you know, here in the Deep South that she had contributed and laid a strong foundation for. So she went to the leadership of SCLC and said, you know, we need to look at what these youth are doing, you know, with these sit-ins in North Carolina and Arkansas. You know, we need to try to galvanize, you know, that energy and harness it for the struggle. So she went with a proposal saying, you know, let's try to convene some of the leaders together and see if we can get them to work on a regional, you know, basis, to do some coordinating and to strike some critical blows against the system. So they helped, you know, foot the bill for that and put some folks together and got some students together. And initially, you know, the leadership in the SCLC thought that, LC thought that, you know, this was just going to be an instrument, for them to control. And, Ella, who, was a profound Democrat with a small D, said, no, you know, they need to chart their own course, utilize their own mind and come up with their own program. And that caused a bit of tension, but eventually through struggle, it kind of got worked out. They wound up having their autonomy and becoming their own organization. But immediately, you know, they started doing some mass work here, particularly around voter registration. You know, they were hit with terror, you know, in other way, terrorism to describe it, which they had to kind of figure out, you know, we can't confront this alone. You know, with you one organization working in Greenwood, another organization working in Jackson, another organization, you know, kind of working in Biloxi with limited organizations that couldn't coordinate efficiently enough on their own to counter the terror and how it was coming down, you know, from the Klan, from the Citizens Council, from the police, from the FBI, you know, from the governor's office, you know, that they had to match that in kind and pull their strength and pull their resources together. And out of that came COFO, right, which was a particular, okay, you know, somewhat unique development during that period of collaboration between, you know, as Malcolm said, the Big Six, for them to kind of, you know, work some things out, you know, to move things on a practical level here in Mississippi to deal with the conditions that they were confronting.
All right, now let me just say this, and then we'll start this interview. Archie Shepp did a song called Malcolm, Super Malcolm, on an album called Fire Music, and he said it could have been called Medgar, Semper Medgar, because he was, you know, he was down with Medgar at that time. But anyway, you have a new book out about you and Ajamu. As long as I've known Ajamu, I can't pronounce his last name. How do you pronounce Ajamu's
last name? Ngawa.
Ngawa. You and Ajamu have a book out. And could you talk about the book and then I guess we can then Melinda can go, I know she has some questions she wanted to do, ask you.
Mm-hmm. Well, me and Ajamu are the editors, the co-editors of the book. It's called Jackson Rising. the struggle for economic democracy and black self-determination in Jackson, Mississippi. And, you know, it's a collection of essays that span a 10-year period. Actually now a little bit longer than that. Plus, actually, that really start with the formation of a plan that came out of the New African People's Organization and the Malcolm X grassroots movement called the Jackson-Cush Plan. And this, in many respects, was a revitalization of plans that go back, you know, if you really want to trace it back, go back to, you know, the founding of Mound Bayou here in Mississippi, which, for folks who don't know, you know, with all African settlement that got founded here during the Reconstruction period in Mississippi up in the Delta area. And if you go back and trace the history of what they were trying to envision, it wasn't just about trying to set up a small isolated oasis. You know, they also had a vision of, you know, how do we set up kind of our base camp area and then from there build out systematically to organize our people throughout the what we now call the Cush District, but the Mississippi Delta was the majority black then and now, and begin the process of liberating our people. So this is an idea that goes back some ways, and it's had different rounds of experimentation, and this was and is the latest round. Trying to use the specific dynamics that exist in, you know, this settler colonial territory called Mississippi, to make a contribution towards the liberation of our people. So the book, charts, a course of action starting around 2005 of how we kind of came up with a strategy, on a plan, to utilize a couple of different components, people's assemblies, cooperative economics, and electoral politics, to move, the register over, a bit further, towards liberation and the mass of people's skills and resources and strength to be used, as a base area, to help liberate our people throughout the U.S. empire. And so that's in a snapshot what the book is kind of aiming to and just trying to provide people, you know, a broad audience who kind of looked at some of the work in Jackson, particularly like I was for the last 5 to 6 years, particularly through the arena of the electoral work that's been done here and trying to figure out is this a model that could and should be emulated? So we wanted to put something out, that spoke to, the thinking that went behind it, the lessons that we've accumulated over that course of time. So people can make some own determinations for themselves, what makes sense, what doesn't make sense, what can you apply in your city, in your area, from the lessons that we've learned, to move some things forward. So that's what the book is trying to be a contribution towards, in short.
You're listening to Diasporic Music on Black Power 96, and Melinda, you had some questions?
Callie, so maybe bringing it back to sort of local and that patient organizing that you so often quote, maybe talk a little bit of a summary of what's been happening in Jackson, Mississippi in that in that sense.
Well,
last year.
I would say to really get a grasp of what's happening here, you got to go back to 1971 and the decision that took place in the provisional government of the Republic of New Africa to set up a capital, a capital of the Republic here in Mississippi. And the decision was made, to do that and to move on it. And the folks were initially trying to set up their capital and found a new city close to a small city near Jackson called Bolton. And this was done primarily under the leadership of Imari Obadeli. And this caused some tension within the PG, the provisional government, But there was, you know, a concerted effort, you know, that was throughout the empire, to galvanize forces, mobilize different forces to come here and make a commitment to move here, and take up the charge, setting up, you know, the capital, and start fighting to, free the land. So one of the people, as history would have, who kind of young brother who picked up at that time, who answered that call was, Tocqueville Lumumba, who, you know, comes, out of Detroit, Michigan by way of, his family roots in Alabama, took up that charge, moved down, and started doing organizing work. And so, you know, his organizing work and the forces around him, you know, goes back to, you know, some 46 years of, you know, kind of patient work that took on a number of different forms. It wasn't just, you know, your normal kind of political agitation that folks might think of as, you know, organizing a rally against police brutality, you know, fighting against, you know, city hall, against, you know, environmental pollution, things of that nature. You know, it involved, everything from organizing sports clubs, which Tocqueville actively did with the Panther basketball team, the New African Panther basketball team that he had set up, you know, here in Jackson. And through that, getting to know, you know, young folks, and trying to instill within them, you know, discipline, sense of how you work together, why it's important to work together, you know, what goals, aims, and objectives you should be, aiming at, which is not just winning a basketball game, but, you know, building your people's strength and capacity towards, liberation. And how do you make all that? You know, how do you make, him and, his wife Nubia, you know, doing things, in the community around art, you know, setting up things and what was the Malcolm X Center that they had here, you know, to teach art, to teach different languages, to teach different skills. You know, those are all different aspects of that long-term patient, organizing, you know, building relationships, trying to shift people's consciousness, trying to get people to, you know, interrogate things around them more critically, more deeply, you know, come up with some, common, you know, understanding of, you know, yeah, why are we all poor? You know, how do we get to this, in this situation? You know, and to realize it's not just happening to me, you know, it's happening to my neighbor, it's happening to the folks, you know, the neighborhood down the way. So we're not isolated in this, and the solutions are not isolated, you know, which is the system trying to get us, to think about things. So, you know, that work took place, and it wasn't just Tocqueville alone who was doing that, of course, you know, but that took place here, you know, for a long, long time. And then I think it took some real critical, shifts really in the late 1980s, that kind of led to the more kind of conscious deliberation that led us to the Jackson-Cush plan. When, as Jackson was making the transition to become a majority black city, you know, still had the white kind of electoral infrastructure. And then during this period in the late 1980s, the police chief was an open member of the Klan and was openly and brazenly just, you know, bruising people. There was a couple of just raw killings that happened, folks, you know, getting, gunned down, you know, in the middle of the street. One case that was central, brother who was a community organizer just got gunned down in front of his family, you know, by some, police officers in town that folks knew to be part of, you know, the Klan. And that really ignited the formation of what became, the first People's Convention, which is the precursor of what became, you know, some 10 years later, the People's Assembly, right? So it's that type of long-term commitment, long-term, work of building relationships, engaging people, you know, politically, ideologically, learning from people as well as, you know, trying to, you know, impart what you know or what you think, and testing ideas to see, hey, is this right or is this wrong? Will this strategy help us, you know, build our strength and gain power? That took place, over a long term period, that then I think took a, you know, we tried to make a qualitative advance on that work, with the articulation of the Jackson-Cush plan and to test out, you know, to what extent, you know, has our organizations had an influence amongst the masses, you know, beyond just the formal membership that was in the organization at that time. You know, how did all that work around, you know, being in the churches, being, you know, in the community centers with the basketball, the sports, and the arts, you know, what impact, you know, did that have? So part of us, you know, running the elections was to test that, you know, to test where we at, where, you know, how many people in the community believe what we believe, you know, and that was one of the initial parts to it. But it took a lot of long-term work, you know, again, the things that you don't necessarily see, but that day-to-day grind, you know, of how you interact with folks in your community to get them to understand you and for you to understand them and to figure out what they have the capacity to do and what they're willing to do and how do you, you know, wield that together and utilize it as a strength to build what you want and to fight against what's oppressing you. So those are things that I would point to and that we were trying to, you know, illustrate in the book, you know, the critical essays there to try to outline some of this history and this methodology of doing work.
Khalid, let me ask you this. We only have about 9 minutes left now. Today we have many black mayors, but I wanted to talk about the black mayors in Jackson, Mississippi, Chuck Wayne's son, Antar Lumumba I, and Ras Baraka, who is the son of Amiri Baraka, is the mayor of Newark, New Jersey. How do you see the those two situations? How do you see those two situations?
They're transitory at best, you know, transitional at best. You know, both of them, I think, are the product of patient work. You know, Amiri, being born and raised in Newark, you know, spent time away, you know, on the West Coast and, you know, and the beat movement and you know, then with, you know, black arts movement, spent some time in Harlem. You know, but eventually came home and started digging in deep at home in Newark and got involved in electoral politics directly, you know, in the late 60s with some of the work that Cap was doing to elect the first black mayor in Newark. And so if folks want to check out some of that history, I think what it's called, what's Camozzi's book, Birth of a Nation or a Nation Within a Nation. A Nation Within a Nation. Yeah. Definitely check that out.
Cap was an organization of Congress of African People, right?
Congress of African People. So they both are very similar histories, you know, very similar local issues that involve patient, systemic, long-term organizing that both of their, you know, children wind up in some parts trying to build upon and extend upon based on that work. Now, the big difference that I think we have to note between the 50s, 60s, 70s, is that that's a weakness that exists, and we got to recognize as such is that, you know, we don't have the organized forces in the community, both political and civic, that existed during that time that actually give strength, to programmatic thrust that Ras Baraka or Sokwe Antar Lumumba want to push out in advance. And we got to recognize that, you know, in order for them to really be in those positions and push a radical agenda, first and foremost, you got to have radical social movements. And in Newark and in Jackson, it's not to say that they don't exist, but we got to be, I think, objective and say they're not strong enough to really, at this point in time, fully counter and defeat, you know, the advance of the right. You know, the advance of reactionary forces and the march that they are on, you know, which we see on the municipal level, we see on the state level, and, of course, everybody sees it, you know, on the federal level, you know, with Mr. Trump. So that's why I say at best they're transitory, you know, that they can move a few things. I think they're actually better at right now, just given the dynamics and the overall balance of forces, you know, on each level, you know, they are doing both a kind of a decent job of trying to preserve the gains from the New Deal, you know, in the New Society or the Great Society, you know, in the programs that got born out of that, you know, from Social Security, to, you know, different forms of health care. They're doing a good job at that, but both, I would argue, if we look at them, have been limited in really pushing forward the full programs that they articulated coming in. And it's not for lack of trying. I want the audience to get that push. It's not that Chokwe or particular Ross, Ross has a longer history. It wasn't for lack of trying to move certain ideas, but without the real strong social movements, they've been limited, and they've been having to deal with, you know, how do you try to make advances in the face of, you know, neoliberal logic and neoliberal orientation, which is about, you know, dismantling the state and privatizing all that can be privatized. You know, so we got some work to do. You know, I think these are experiments that we can learn from. We have to learn from. I think there's some pursuits worth engaging in both. But I just hope there's folks, you know, in other cities who are looking at the experience in Jackson, look at the experience in Newark, and take the right lessons from it, at least from my vantage point, about us building the strength and the capacity of the black working class to be the transformative agent, and not just look at the mayors being kind of the end all of the force that's going to move it. That's not how history works, you know, not how it ever worked. You know, so they can move some things from that position, but it's the people who ultimately have to build their capacity and strength to transform society, you know, and we shouldn't forget that. We can't forget that, in examining what's happening in these two cities and others.
Are you listening to Diasporic Music on, Black Power 96? Melinda, this is the last question.
Yeah. If you had like a crystal ball, what do you think is upcoming in the new year?
Sadly, I don't think it takes a crystal ball to recognize we're gonna be dealing with a lot of pain and suffering 2018. You know, reactionary forces are they on a death march, and they fully intend to unleash. They might. On us in the here and now, and we better not sleep on it. We better not be, you know, blind to it. We better not act surprised, you know, at the things that they're trying to do, and we better take, you know, the moment seriously and get organized. You know, stop playing, get organized, and get prepared to fight back. You know, with everything we got. You know, because. These folks is, you know, nothing short of genocidal maniacs, and we just got to stop acting like they're not.
So you believe I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I know you are a person that believes it's imperialism, not necessarily it's not Trump, it's the system, I guess.
It's the system, yeah. Trump is just a. An agent of the system, just a manifestation of the system. Everything that, you know, Trump is, was, spoke to, that's always been there. You know, as long as this settler colonial project has been around, these dynamics, the logic that he represents, the position that he represents, that's been there. You know, it's the logic of manifest destiny. It's the logic of divine providence. It's the logic of, might makes right. It's the logic that you know, whiteness is the greatest thing since sliced bread. None of this is new. You know, and the fact that he is just articulating these ideas just speaks to how much they have out-organized outside of the equation, truth be told. You know, because it's not like those thoughts went away or those social forces went away. They were, for a while, because of our strength and momentum from the 40s, 50s, 60s, up through the 80s, I would say, you know, we contained them for a while. I'm talking about specifically the Black Liberation Movement and others. We weren't the only one, but we contained them for a while, which forced them to, you know, come up with some